And here are those verses. This is Ephesians 2, 14 and 15, and then 16 as well. For Christ himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by setting aside in his flesh the law with its commands and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace, and in one body to reconcile both through the cross, by which he put to death their hostility. I don't think that I need to convince you that the division and hostility in our country has reached fever pitch. The way that we interact with each other, especially with our enemies, is dysfunctional at best. And I know humanity's ancient story is riddled with tribalism and hatred. In some ways, this is not new. And yet something about this moment seems unique. Hostility is rampant on all sides. It seems that we are stuck in an old way of being human, and the consequences are quite devastating. Family members have stopped talking to each other. Neighbors mumble hostility as they walk by each other's political yard signs. And as I talk to people and examine my own life, it seems that far too often these days, hatred and hopelessness are taking root. I don't want to state the obvious, but I'm going to state the obvious. The way that we are trying to live out our humanity is not working, which makes God's invitation, I think, all the more urgent and compelling. Because God is inviting us into a new way of being human. A new humanity is being formed in and through Christ. And the question before us is whether we will embody this new humanity or stay stuck in our old ways. So we're taking these weeks leading up to the election and the weeks that will immediately follow to be honest and to examine our own hearts and ask ourselves what it would mean for us, for me, to more fully embody this new humanity, to stop the cycle of labeling and distancing and dismissal, and instead have the courage and grace to love, even to love our enemies. And we all have them. Do we not? We all have enemies. In fact, I don't know if you would be courageous and brave enough. I think you are. I'd be interested to hear just who your enemies are. And I'm not looking for names here. Let's be very clear. Please do not put names in the chat window. But more generally speaking, you know, who are the people who are our enemies? Would you include those in the chat window? Would you type something if you're at a watch party? You can maybe gather a couple of people's ideas and throw them in the chat window all at once. So you're probably saying something general here, like the people who have a different political opinion than I do, right? That could be an enemy in a way of communicating that this morning without naming your neighbor specifically as someone who is your enemy. But who are the people that we're really having a hard time loving right now? What would you say about that? The man, yes. And we all might define that perhaps a bit differently. That's what the Petters are feeling. Yep. Appreciate that, Stephanie, and your honesty. That's what we need in this moment. So she says, I'm really having a hard time with people who vote a certain way. Good. Yeah, Lene and Trevor, conspiracy theorists. Mm-hmm. Janelle's just saying politicians in general feel like the enemy to her. Mm-hmm. Appreciate all of those honest answers. Any others? Yeah, people who devalue humanity. People who deny that racism even exists. Yep. Indeed. Social media. Interesting. Yeah, so just in general, the people that we might encounter there. I assume that's what you're thinking about, Lindsay. Yeah. That's good. Keep it coming. I don't feel like you can't enter any more here. I'm gonna keep moving us on, but people who don't like the Lions, that's probably not a bad one to end on, although I do see one more here. People who say charged things, but not in a way that promotes healthy discussion, which is most everyone these days. That's how it feels anyway. That's the, I think, perception we might easily have. Thanks, Lene, Trevor. Kevin, I don't know what I'm gonna do with your comment. I'm just gonna let it be. All right. Oh, shoot, I couldn't let it be. Someone else had to step in. Mm-hmm. Someone had, okay, now folks, we are talking, just remember, I want to remind us, we're talking about one new humanity. Let's not tear each other down here this morning. Okay, closing the chat window, although I don't think I have the power to do that, unfortunately. Okay, I appreciate that honesty in all seriousness. I mean, I think the point, maybe one point to take from that quick little assessment is that we have enemies. And maybe some of them we fight with outwardly, we actually argue with, or we confront physically. But I think a lot of the conflict and the hostility lives up here. Most of us are pretty nice people. We're West Michigan nice. And so we don't fight, not publicly at least, but there's all kinds of turmoil and things festering and stewing within us. And so I think it's important to just acknowledge that we have enemies and to remind ourselves of this call to love our enemy. But to be clear here this morning, I do want to say this. Loving your enemy does not mean turning a blind eye to injustice or pain. Okay? The scriptures, I think, are consistent and clear. Injustice must be faced. We are to be people who name injustice when we see it, people who are motivated then by love, actually, to use our voice and our power to move those who have caused pain and harm, to move them, to try and compel them, to hold them accountable so that they would take ownership and make amends. So loving your enemy does not mean turning a blind eye to injustice or pain, nor does it mean that we will always agree if we love our enemy. In fact, you may never agree with your enemy, but I'm not sure that agreement is the goal. The goal, the consistent call of God is to love. If we happen to agree as well, that's a win. But we need to be honest, that just is not going to always happen. So agreement isn't the goal. It can certainly be something we are striving for. But in the end, the call is one of love. So I just want to say those things kind of up front here. And then ask this question, you know, how do we embody this new humanity? How do we love our enemy? And as we talked about last week, it begins by rehumanizing our enemies. Someone said that in the chat window, the way in which we devalue human beings. And it's not just that one side or one tribe or one political party dehumanizes. This is just a common tendency across the board. We turn people into things, something to overcome, something to prove wrong, something to defeat. That's what people become instead of these fully human, as we talked about last week, fully human people made by God, bearing God's image. And so we have to start here, I think. We have to rehumanize our enemies. And then we can build on that, I think. We can build on this shared identity that we have. And we can move towards and begin to embrace humility. Listen to these verses from Ephesians 4, 1 to 3. Paul's writing from prison. And he says, therefore, I, a prisoner for serving the Lord, beg you, beg you to lead a life worthy of your calling. For you have been called by God. Called to do what? To always be humble and gentle. Be patient with each other, making allowance for each other's faults because of your love. Make every effort to keep yourselves united in the Spirit, binding yourselves together with peace. Verse 2 says, always be humble and gentle. One translation has it this way, be completely humble, through and through humble. Not humble when it happens to work for you or humble every now and then, but always be completely humble and gentle. Well, what does humility look like? Well, let me offer four things that I think we are able to say when we are embodying humility. Four things that we are able to say even to our enemy when we are living with humility. And here they are. We are able to say, I am finite. We are able to say, I may be wrong. I may not see the whole picture. And we're even able to say, I need you. If you want to know if you are embodying humility, ask yourself, am I able to and am I currently saying these sorts of things, even when it comes to those I disagree with, those who are my enemy? You know, I am finite. That comes throughout the scriptures, human beings having to admit that they are human. Psalm 103, the psalmist writes, the life of mortals is like grass. They flourish like a flower of the field. Then the wind blows over it and it is gone and its place remembers it no more. I'm telling you, the scriptures hold no punches. They're like, listen, you've got to own the reality that you are finite, that your days are not forever on this earth. Our ego might try and convince us otherwise, but again, the scriptures say something different. And humility is being willing to admit that this is true, that you are not the complete package, that you do not know everything there is to know, that you are not always right, which really leads to this next one. Can we say, I may be wrong? Your pride goes before destruction and haughtiness before a fall, so says the Proverbs writer. Right? Arrogance, the belief that I am right, that I have all the answers, that I know exactly what to do every time. That sort of attitude and embodiment leads to destruction of relationship, of even ourselves. Pride just doesn't damage our relationship with the rest of the world. It does something to us and our heart. So being able to say I may be wrong is actually really important and a really healthy sign of a human being who's following after Jesus. So I'm finite, I may be wrong, I may not see the whole picture. Proverbs 11:2, pride leads to disgrace, but with humility comes wisdom. And pride leads to conflict. Those who take advice are wise. You know, the ability to admit that someone other than you, perhaps even your enemy, may know things that you do not know, may have experienced things you have not experienced, may help give a fuller, more complete understanding of the world. This is what it means to be humble. And it all leads to being able to say this, I need you. 1 Corinthians 12, Paul is writing about this body metaphor, this metaphor that's meant to help us understand our relationships to each other. And Paul says, yes, there are many parts, but only one body, and the eye can never say to the hand, I don't need you, and the head can't say to the feet, I don't need you. Right? We are stuck, I think, today in an old way of being human. Whenever we think that we don't need anyone else, if we think that our side, our camp, our tribe has the entire truth, we are moving toward destruction, the scriptures say. No human being can legitimately say, I don't need you. Why? Because we are finite. Because sometimes we are wrong. Because we may not see the whole picture. And so humility is being able to say these things to each other and even to our enemies. And I just invite you to pause here for a moment and do a little check of yourself. If you were to imagine your enemy right now, whoever that might be, can you imagine saying these things to them? Or maybe if that's just way too far out there, can you imagine saying these things to yourself while you are considering your enemy or engaging them? And notice, maybe wrong, you might be right. So oftentimes, I suppose we are, but you might also not be. And you may certainly have part of the picture. But there's no way one person can hold the entire thing. Can you imagine saying these things this morning? Let me tell you a story about one of my enemies. You know, as you may know, or you may not know, I am an ordained minister in the Reformed Church in America, which is why I prefer to be called the Reverend whenever addressed. And if you didn't know that, now you do. You know, becoming ordained is a process. It's quite a long process, actually. Not only do you have to complete a master's degree, but you also must pass a series of exams, mostly oral exams, in front of a body of pastors and elders called a classis. I know I'm throwing out all this language here, but a classis is just a group of churches, and the pastors that pastor those churches and the elders that help to lead those churches. And so it's not only that you have to pass all of your tests and write all of your papers in seminary, but then on top of that, at the end of every school year, you have to come in front of this body of people and be examined again, usually orally, in a way in which the other people who are there can ask you, the student, any question they want. Sounds fun, right? Real fun. Well, I didn't grow up in the Reformed Church in America in this denomination. And so when I learned that this was part of the process, that not only was I going to have to complete a Master's of Divinity, which is the most ridiculous sounding degree ever, not only that, but I was going to also have to pass these oral exams every year. I mean, I nearly had a heart attack. Well, maybe not, but I did lose most of my hair, and that's not an exaggeration. It was incredibly stressful for me. And what made it even more fun was that there was a pastor in this classes, in this group of pastors. We'll call him Jimmy. And Jimmy took these exams very seriously and had over the years developed a reputation for being a brutal examiner who sometimes wasn't just tough, sometimes was unfair and even unkind in the way that he would treat students. And I experienced his reputation firsthand. I remember being examined in theology, which, as you might imagine, for a pastor is kind of a big exam, you know. And Jimmy was in attendance, of course. You knew he would be. And he asked me a particular question. And I knew, actually, that he was going to ask this question because he had such a reputation that students who had gone on before had collected the questions he had asked them and had passed it on to students down the line because his questions were so minute, they were so over the top that students were trying to help students out. So I knew he was going to ask me this question, and I gave an answer that I thought was really good. But he didn't think so. So he asked a follow-up question and then another one. And by this time, I'm starting to stumble and I'm not even exactly sure what to say anymore. And he keeps pressing and pushing into me. And it's not until the person leading the exam stops the exam that I realize I'm shaking and I'm just hot and sweaty everywhere. And I'll tell you what, that day, Jimmy became an enemy for me. And in some ways, I want to stop the story right there. I want to stop telling you about Jimmy so that you can hate him the way that I did. And so that we can live in this dichotomy, you know, where Jimmy was bad and I was good, where Jimmy was wrong and I was right, where Jimmy was the enemy. And then I could just dismiss him and be done with him. But if I embody humility or attempt to do that, then I have to admit to you that neither Jimmy or any other human being for that matter is that simple or that black and white. You see, I had a relationship with Jimmy, not a friendship, to be clear, but a relationship for over a decade with Jimmy. Because my 4 years as a student and then for 6 years after I graduated, we were in the same classes. And so we would see each other at least twice a year. And I'll tell you about another way that we saw each other as well. So I couldn't get rid of Jimmy. And that's what we want to do with our enemies, right? We want to just get them as far away as possible. I didn't really have a choice. I had no power in that way. I could choose to not interact with him in certain ways. Again, we didn't become best friends. But there was some interactions I couldn't escape. And I'll tell you what, while I did not like it, I think it was really important and ultimately transformative for me that I couldn't get rid of Jimmy in my life. I'll tell you a couple of examples. When I was still in seminary and I was losing most of my hair, again, not a joke, Jimmy and some other pastors took myself, a student, and other students out for lunch. And while I knew the lunch included Jimmy, it was being paid for by not me. And so I went. And I just happened to sit next to Jimmy at lunch. And he asked me in the course of conversation, how are you doing? And not like a, hey, how are you? But like, hey, how's it going? And again, it wasn't going particularly well at the time. And I told him that. And he ended up sharing with me his own struggles in seminary and how hard it was for him to make the transition from college to graduate school and on and on and on. And then he mailed me a book that he found really helpful when he was kind of in that same place going through seminary. And so I went home from that lunch that day really conflicted, because I wanted to dismiss this guy, even maybe honestly hate him a little bit. And yet here I was realizing that Jimmy helped me see a fuller picture of my own life, of all things. I was so narrowly kind of trapped in the difficulty and the challenge. And by talking to him, again, I didn't even want to admit it, I realized I wasn't alone. I wasn't the only person who had ever struggled in the way that I was. And I found someone who was compassionate to me in that moment and kind and helpful. I couldn't see the whole picture at that point in my life, and Jimmy helped give me a little piece of reality that I couldn't see on my own. Years later, when I graduated from seminary, and now Jimmy and I were peers in the same classes, there was this question before our classes of whether or not our denomination should adopt a new, what's called confessional, which I know you're ready to go to sleep, but hang in there here. This one actually mattered. Our denomination at the time had three confessionals, three documents, all of them written in the 1500s and 1600s, okay, long time ago, that were kind of the theological foundation for the denomination. A lot of the theology rose out of those three. Well, out of apartheid, the church in South Africa wrote a confessional called the Belhar Confession that was focused on reclaiming and restating what our relationship to each other was supposed to be like. It condemned racism in all of its forms. It called for unity. It's really quite a beautiful document. And there was a movement in the late aughts, about 2009, that our denomination was thinking about adding the Belhar Confession, this document against racism, to our list of confessionals, of which there were only three. And again, they had all been approved 400 years ago. So this may not seem like a big deal, but to geeks and pastors, it kind of is. So there's this pretty contentious debate going on at a classes meeting, and we're going to vote about whether or not we should take the Belhar Confession in. And who stands up but Jimmy? And this guy was brilliant. Stands up and gives a compelling, passionate, solid call for the denomination to take this necessary step of condemning racism, of drawing closer to our brothers and sisters who are not Dutch white guys. And his little speech, in a sense, shifts the whole conversation. The whole thing pivots. Now, maybe without him doing that, we still vote to approve it. I don't know, of course. But in that moment, my enemy was the person who stood up and who did what needed to be done. I mean, in really a very real way, I needed Jimmy in that moment to be who Jimmy was and to move us in a direction we needed to go. Now, here's an ironic twist. Jimmy, the guy who loved to grill students at their examinations. Well, after I graduated from seminary, I was asked by our classes to chair the team that oversaw these student exams. And guess who was on that team? Jimmy. Jimmy and I had some interesting meetings together because, remember, loving your enemy does not mean that you turn a blind eye to injustice or to a lack of love or to unkindness. And so Jimmy, I had to confront him as the person leading this team now. I needed to confront him on the way that he sometimes behaved in classes, exams. And I won't pretend those did not always go particularly well. We did not always leave agreeing. But through the course of years, 3 years together on that team, we ended up dramatically changing the way that exams happened. And we shifted really the whole tone for how that whole process went. And I know I'm kind of ending here on a happy note and look how everything worked out great. I'll tell you, it is not that simple. There were times when I could not stand this guy, where he made me so angry, where we did not agree, and I really don't think I loved him. But there were also times when humility won the day, where by the grace of God's Spirit, I was able to say things like, I may need him. And I may not see the whole picture, and I might even be wrong about some things. So let me come back to these questions or these statements here for a moment. And let me just pause and ask you again to think about an enemy, your enemy, be it an individual or kind of a group or a certain tribe or a certain perspective. And I wonder if today, could you admit that you are finite? That may be step enough today to just take an honest stock of the reality of who we are. But I wonder, could you also entertain the idea that there might be times when you might be wrong? That's true with the people who you are closest to. And again, those folks out there somewhere. Or that maybe you're not wrong. Maybe it's more that that person or that group of people at their best do help give a fuller picture and understanding of the world, that they do in fact have something to offer. Yeah, maybe it gets lost in all of the noise and the sound bites and the hostility. Can we entertain the possibility of that person having something perhaps that I need? I want to take those questions and or those statements, and I want you to just continue to hold them for a moment as we listen to a song by the band The Brilliance. And it's a song that gets at everything we're talking about today. of getting caught in the headlines and having the headlines of today move us towards hatred for each other. But in fact, the truth and the reality is that there is a love so deep, so pervasive, so strong, a love that is everywhere, all around us. And that love, if we are open, can take root in our heart and can lead us toward a greater love for even our enemy. So let's listen here to this song. Use it as a time to reflect, to continue to think about these statements here. And then we'll come back together and have communion with each other. Let me encourage you, if you don't mind, a quick flip off your video. And we'll share in this song here together.